Hey, this is Anthony, and I'm the host of What They Did Not Teach You in School, the podcast that interviews people to get their wisdom recorded so that hopefully you could learn some things that are not taught in school, but should be taught in school. I'd like to remind people that a lot of the things talked about on this podcast relate to investing and finance. The purpose of talking about these subjects are to hopefully inform people and educate them on financial literacy, and to entertain people with some do's and do nots. This is not to be considered financial advice. Before trying anything that you learn on the podcast, be sure to consult a professional.
Joining me today is co-host Anthony Chiaravallotti, founder of Liberty Horizons, King Street Media, and Creator Club, our sponsor and our recording studio today. With over a decade of experience in tax planning, Anthony provides a good perspective on how Canadian entrepreneurs might view these policy changes. Also with us is Alexei Mojeko, a management consultant at Accenture specializing in central bank digital currencies and digital assets. An economist by training, Alexei is interested in how the fiscal and monetary policies of the government are shaping Canada's economy and future. And I'm Kieran McConnell, a management consultant at Accenture focusing on rolling out 5G mobility technologies at critical infrastructure sites in Canada and the US. My background as an economist and my experience volunteering and working in political arenas both in Canada and in Europe fuels my interest in how Canada, or any country for that matter, can best incentivize innovation, enterprise, and economic growth. Join us as we delve into Tyler's insights and experiences, uncover the lessons that go beyond the textbooks, and offer a real-world look into what goes into writing policies like the federal budget. Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of What They Did Not Teach You in School. I'm Kieran McConnell. I'm here with Anthony Chiaravallotti and Alexei Mojeko, and we have a very special guest today, Tyler Meredith, founder of Meredith and Bosenkohl Policy Advisors, former lead economic and fiscal policy advisor for Justin Trudeau, Chrystia Freeland, and Bill Morneau.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Thank you. So, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself? What are you working on these days?
So I left government at the end of fall of 2022, and since then took a little bit of time off, and I obviously run a consulting company, as you just mentioned, and I also teach at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy, and it's actually really interesting to be both a consultant and a teacher because you have to explain to both groups, very different audiences, you have to explain things very simply.
Yeah. So tell us a bit more about your company, Meredith and Bosenkohl. Why did you start it? What kind of work do you guys do, clients?
So prior to when I was in government, I was in both management consulting and then subsequently in the think tank world. And when I was leaving government, I thought, well, I don't want to go back to a big five management consulting firm. No offense. I've done that. It's an interesting experience. I wanted to try something new. I didn't want to go back to the think tank world because it's a bit more staid compared to what I had seen and done in politics. And so I was like, well, how can I marry these different skill sets? And what's interesting about what we do, and both for myself and my business partner, Ken Bosenkohl, we both are people who've been kind of around the academic world. We both worked at think tanks. We actually both have the same academic mentor, about 20 years apart or 25 years apart, but we have the same academic mentor at different parts of our careers. And we both have written platforms, he for Stephen Harper, me for Justin Trudeau. We both worked on economic policy inside government and outside government. And so we were like, well, if the two of us have these mutually complementary skills, but one's conservative, one's liberal, maybe by working together, we can actually improve public policy for whether you're a for-profit company, whether you're a philanthropic foundation, or whether you're a trade association, just to think about not just how you practice politics, but also what is a fully formed policy idea that can go into government.
I'm sure you guys have great debates over a glass of wine. How is that being business partners with someone from a different political POV?
Well, I mean, I think for our clients, it's huge value, right? Because we actually do sometimes argue with each other in front of our clients. And that's actually valuable because you get to see the different perspectives that are out there. But also, there are lots of issues, and we sometimes don't talk about this enough in politics. There are lots of issues on which there really isn't a liberal or a conservative or a New Democrat view on something, right? There isn't a liberal view or a conservative view on how to do insurance necessarily, right? You just, you know, climate change is going to happen. We have to insure for the risks that are coming at us. So how do we deal with that? There are different questions perhaps about the role of government in that respect. But we still have to solve those problems. And so to a certain extent, as you can move past those and think about, so how do our political viewpoints inform policy? If there's a common solution that we can land on, usually that would mean that it's probably something worthwhile doing.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So would you say that your clients, you mentioned nonprofits, different mm-hmm. charities, organizations, so you're consulting them with respect to how policy might affect them?
So there's three kinds of things that we would do. And this is very different, I would say, than your traditional government relations firm who you would hire to go and lobby. One, because I can't lobby. Yeah. I have certain restrictions as a former public office holder. But, Ken and I are very different, obviously, in terms of our value add, because we're more policy people. And there are policy people at lots of GR firms. It's just those are often very vertically integrated GR firms that will do your digital ads and that will tell you also how to lobby and really build a campaign. That's mm-hmm. not exactly what we do. What we do is, one, what I call policy therapy. I should trademark that term. It's kind of like if you're a heavily regulated, federally regulated business or a trade association and you have a lot of different issues and you need to figure out, so what should I care about? What shouldn't I care about? How do I manage this relative to a 6, 12, 24-month agenda? It's really figuring that out and coaching people a little bit about how to engage on what and in what manner, and whether that's at the public service level, the political level, or even just in a kind of policy influencer space. Second would be kind of issue and campaign support, where there's a specific regulatory decision that needs to occur, and there's some degree of advice that someone might benefit from around just understanding what does that process look like, how to think through how to engage at both the regulatory side and the political side, because if you're a minister, who's going to make a decision with the ministerial order that, you're going to take in a lot of different inputs. And the third would be thought leadership. Because both Ken and I have worked in the think tank world, we've both written academic peer-reviewed pieces to our names in addition to being in politics. We can do versions of what I call white label thought leadership, which is kind of like a think tank paper that an association or a group might put out. So we do work with different clients on each one of those three things.
Right. Interesting. So the balanced perspective probably helps a lot when people appreciate that as well. So it's not like a specifically just partisan perspective.
That's right.
Cool. So let's get into the capital gains stuff. So we all have probably been watching the news about the capital gains inclusion rate. Could you maybe explain, I guess, from your own perspective, having worked in that side of the government, what the rationale behind the decision to increase capital gains inclusion rate would have been?
So there's a couple of different ways you can approach that question. So I think in its broadest sense, in terms of what the government itself was trying to do, it has a very ambitious agenda to solve significant problems facing our economy, probably the most important of which is a lack of housing. And to the degree of what is needed for that investment, some people will say, well, why can't we just find savings elsewhere in government? Mm-hmm. You could find some savings in government, but if you're going to spend $20-odd billion of money on an ambitious agenda, especially in what the Prime Minister has described as the biggest plan to reinvest in housing, you're going to probably need a new source of revenue because there just isn't the fiscal space currently to do that amidst a lot of other priorities, whether that's, investment tax credits to spur growth in clean technologies, or whether we're dealing with a transition towards decarbonization or defense spending, right? So there's lots of pressures on the public purse. And so we've probably got to, if we're going to address those pressures long term, because we need a new source of revenue. So then the question is, if we have a new source of revenue, what should be the best way to raise that marginal dollar? And one of the things, in Canada that we haven't talked a lot about, we talk a lot about income inequality, we don't talk a lot about wealth inequality. Mm-hmm. When you look at the effective tax rate that people pay over time, so not the rate, but the actual amount that they pay divided by their total income in a given year, if you were to chart that on a graph in Canada, you would see that the effective tax rate effectively rises as income rises all the way along until you get to about the top 0.1%. Yep. And then it falls. And it falls because of the differential composition of income that happens at the top end of the distribution, where a lot of people who are higher income also tend to have lots of assets, and therefore their preference, because of the way of our current tax system, they're preferenced to take more of that income in the form of capital than they are in the form of ordinary salary income, right? And so in Canada, as we know, you have three different ways in which you can derive income. You have income that you can get from salary or from the market, right? What we call market income. You can get dividend income, which would be, you know, a dividend that you receive on behalf of owning Canadian or non-Canadian shares. And then you can also get capital income. There's also interest income, of course, but that will depend a little bit about where you are in your tax rate. But effectively, those are the three sources, general sources of how we differentiate income. And for capital income, if you sell something, right, we obviously shield certain types of assets from what's considered taxable, right? Principal residence is not taxable. But if you have a taxable capital income, we only include half of that potential gain in what you would then pay at your relevant tax rate. And so because of that, there is a strong preference, because you have 100% of your salary included, but only 50% of your capital included. There's a preference, if you can, to try to characterize more of your income in the form of capital as opposed to ordinary income. And so, not surprisingly, we have seen a lot of top-end income earning households taking more of their income in the form of capital and capital gains. And so what this does is it says, well, we're going to instead just raise slightly the inclusion rate from 50 to 60, about 67%, so that effectively more of those earnings are subject to tax at the rates in which they would be taxed, with some obvious exclusions, which we can get into. But the point being, it's to try to, one, address that kink in the curve, what we call the Buffett curve. Warren Buffett came up with that, was one of the first kind of non-academic people to really put his finger on that issue about 10 or 15 years ago. And it's less of a concern in Canada than it is in the U.S., but it does exist in Canada. And so it's, one, addressing that wealth inequality issue, and two, trying to do it in a way that raises a meaningful amount of money, because we have big needs to invest in housing and defense and decarbonization.
Yeah, when I was in wealth management, one of the biggest tax strategies for high net worth individuals was, how do we make the majority of your income and portfolio a capital gain versus interest and dividend income? And that was like the loophole in order to try and save people tons of taxes. And the more wealth that you accumulate, the more of a big discrepancy that is, from a percentage standpoint, like you were saying.
So. Absolutely. And I think what's interesting about this change, right, is the government, if you look over its history of the eight and a half or so years that it's been in office, it's made a lot of different tax changes. It's closed some loopholes in other parts of the tax system. It's done some targeted industry-specific surtaxes, like in the financial services sector. It's tightened audit and enforcement, which has in and of itself also raised more money indirectly. But this is the first big structural change across the board in the tax system that we've seen in the time that the government's been in power. And it's kind of because, this, as you were saying, there exists this phenomenon out there, but also there aren't as many different levers that are left to pull. And so back to the point about, you need to raise a meaningful amount of money, a lot of the other choices they probably had at their disposal wouldn't have hit that mark.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. If I'm understanding this correctly, taxes have two fundamental functions. One is to raise funds for the government to accomplish policy objectives. The second is to adjust consumer behavior. Whether that's a decision between earning capital income versus wage income, or buying cigarettes or not buying cigarettes, taxes are effective at changing customer behavior. If you were to look at this policy, where would you say that balance is between these two effects?
So it's important to probably note that the way in which we tax capital has changed a fair bit over the course of Canadian history. Now, the current version of what we have, we've lived with in terms of the 50% inclusion rate since about the year 2000, 2001. But before that, we actually had an inclusion rate that was 75%. Before that, we had an inclusion rate that was around 67%, then 50%, and then at one time even zero. And so the reason that we went from zero to 50 back in the early 1970s as a result of what was called the Carter Commission was because the idea was that we wanted to strike a balance between saying, on one hand, that we should incentivize investment, and we should probably treat investments somewhat preferentially because we want to encourage, to your point, more investment. There's a positive externality that we're trying to generate as opposed to taxing a negative externality. But a dollar should be a dollar, right? That was the principle, that every dollar generated in the economy should as close to as possible be taxed in the same way, so that there isn't separately a separate kind of dynamic that occurs, as you were saying earlier, about encouraging a certain kind of behavior. Now, I think we can say that over time, as, for example, business investment in Canada has slowed down, which happened quite a fair bit after we actually lowered the inclusion rate in the early 2000s from 75 to 50, that if the desire was to get a higher amount of productivity and investment in our economy, this clearly hasn't worked as the channel in which to generate that. And so if you want to address productivity and innovation in Canada, which obviously we have an issue with, maybe this doesn't yield the benefits that we would think that it would. And so, to your question, I think the goal of it was largely how can we most efficiently raise a large amount of money to invest in things like housing? Because if we can address the imbalance in our housing market, that actually will provide a future path for growth, right? What's interesting, and we don't hear this actually a lot post-budget as we did pre-budget, but before the budget was tabled, there was a study that was done by KPMG. I think it was with the Canadian Chamber of Commerce, but I'm not 100% sure on that. But it was a C-suite survey done by KPMG, and what it found in talking to 500 or so C-suite members across the country was that the number one issue that was raised by business owners and by senior executives was housing. That was the single biggest economic concern that they were raising, because they were worried that the lack of affordable housing market in our country would mean that it would limit our ability to bring in talent and retain talent, right? And so as a really talent-oriented country, if we can't do that, it will limit our future growth. Well, we've got to address that, we've got to pay for a pretty ambitious housing strategy. So I think the goal was really to find sources of revenue to pay for that at scale.
Right. And then in terms of like the net effect, obviously a lot of, I guess, the producers in the economy, you'd say, the investors, the entrepreneurs, the business owners, a lot of people out west, evidently in the oil industry, obviously tag this increase in capital gains tax as like a disincentive for them to be risking their capital and developing out kind of productive industry. Would you say that anticipation or that expectation is misguided, or that it would be, or that the net effect would be?
Sounds like you wanted to say something first before I jump in on that.
So you mentioned something that was like, a lot of these business owners are saying the point around, like, particularly about raising capital, it's like, oh, it de-incentivized people in the startup industry.
Yeah.
In an already struggling Canadian VC or like private equity space. What's your thoughts on that?
Okay, so I think it's important to start by acknowledging that the vast, vast, vast majority of Canadians will never have a taxable gain in the entirety of their life, because they just happen to be exposed to assets and are saving in a way that isn't taxable, right? So most people put most of their savings equity into their house. Principal residences are exempt. Most people will, if they're rational, they will first maximize their TFSA and their RRSP, again, tax exempt. So, and there's a recent longitudinal study that was done looking at tax filers over 10-year period up to about 2018-19. And what it found was that 81% of people never generated a capital gain ever. Now, it's possible that, you know, if they inherit some wealth down the road, some portion of that 81% might come down a little bit, but not a lot, because remember, over a 10-year period, we're dealing with lots of lives, you know, births and deaths. We're dealing with lots of changes in household circumstances. So it's a pretty good representative sample to kind of say most people don't ever have a taxable capital gain, right? So this conversation is really isolated to a certain subset of people in our society, and I think sometimes we lose perspective about that. The second point I would make is, but obviously we need to encourage entrepreneurship in this country, and obviously we need to encourage risk-taking. And yes, Canada has seen a decline in the number of people who are entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. What's interesting, though, is that decline, right, happened over 20 years at the same time in which we were making it more tax efficient and tax preferred to invest in a business. So clearly taxes, if you were expecting to be the lever that would generate more productivity, more business investment, and more entrepreneurship, did none of those three things over the last 25 years. So not to say that raising those taxes will do the opposite, that it would encourage those things to happen. But my point is, maybe what we're realizing is that these things are a lot more complicated in how those decisions are made. And certainly as it relates to entrepreneurship, one of the reasons why entrepreneurship has slowed down, if you look at the research that the Bank of Canada has done, is actually because we've seen a larger concentration of large firms in Canada. Why does that matter? because large firms pay higher wages, right? And when they pay higher wages, there are golden handcuffs to stay as opposed to innovate, to turn over new ideas, to take risks, right? In a way that we see in other economies in the world. So we have a challenge in this country around innovation. We have a challenge in this country around competition. And I think it's fair to say that these changes might at the margins potentially make those worse. But in aggregate, when we look at what's happened over the last 20 or 25 years, I think there's a lot of evidence to say the tax is not the reason that we are currently facing the challenges that we do. The reason that we don't have significant venture capital in this country is because we also don't have a business sector that's investing in those things. Yeah. Like the dirty little secret about venture capital, that most venture capital funds in Canada, even if they're privately run, have a significant amount of co-investment that's happening by BDC, right? Which is government-backed money.
Yeah.
And so like you step back and you're like, wow, it's a lot more complicated than what I hear from some of these stakeholder groups.
So what advice would you give to a young Canadian entrepreneur? You know, they read this headline, they read the news, and they feel discouraged. They want to hold on to their golden handcuffs. What advice would you give to a young entrepreneur navigating this, you know, marginal change in
so I think it actually kind of depends a little bit the industry that they're in, right? Because if you're in tech, obviously your goal as an exit strategy is going to be to try to go IPO or to sell to somebody, and you're going to care about valuation, you're going to care about capital, because the primary way in which you're probably going to extract value from what you build is going to be on the capital side, right? But if you're developing a goods manufacturing business, or if you're developing even a normal kind of service business that isn't in tech, likelihood is you're going to generate lots of cash flow over time, or that's the goal. And you're going to probably take money out of your company, not through an exit to monetize for, you know, public or another buyer. You're going to take dividend income, right? Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about this change is this actually equalizes effectively the effective tax rate between capital income and dividend income. So I don't think from a tax perspective necessarily an entrepreneur, unless they're in a very specific area of the market, that they're going to be disadvantaged by this. But the other thing I would say is even if they are, they also need to take a look at, you know, the relevance of why they're developing something in Canada versus in the United States, right? The United States, under Joe Biden, is currently proposing a tax rate on capital gains that is going to be higher than where this will end up if it's legislated by the government of Canada. And we'll see whether or not, if A, Joe Biden gets reelected, B, whether he has the seats in Congress to be able to do that. But my point is, governments across the world are looking at raising capital taxes because I think there is this broader discussion about wealth inequality that's been happening for the last number of years. So my message to that entrepreneur, that person who wants to potentially start, don't be discouraged. Canada's a great place to invest. I think there is a need for us to continue to look at how to support innovation, but there's probably other ways for us to do that than this.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's a good point that you said there. Like, I would say probably, I don't know, I'm just going to shoot a number out there, but probably like 98%, 99% of business owners in Canada make the majority of their money through dividends and profits outside of the corporation. Absolutely. So like that even narrows it down to an even smaller amount of people that would actually, especially in Canada, make their wealth through like some kind of like exit. Mm-hmm. And even at that, it's only 17% more that's included in that, which even at 50% is
just over
8% more of taxes that need to be paid. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's interesting how much media attention this has got. Do you want to talk a little bit about why you think there's so much media attention about this one policy, maybe versus other ones that are probably more relevant to a bigger audience?
So just before I do that, to even go further on your point, I think it's important to note that there's also other exceptions that have been built into this policy, which haven't gotten a lot of attention, and maybe that's, you know, to be expected, but it really also narrows the case of who's affected here. One is, if you're affected on the personal side, you have a $250,000 exclusion. So any gain you make in a given year that's less than $250,000, you're going to still be subject to the 50%. And it's only the dollar above $250,000 that is then going to have the, as you say, the 17 percentage points more. Now, for corporation, that still doesn't, that same treatment doesn't exist in the sense that their first dollar, they're going to be taxed at the new rate. But when the business owner goes to sell, potentially, they're going to have a lifetime capital gains exemption that now is going to rise from about $1 million to $1.25 million, so a 25% increase. And they're also, if they're in certain industries, they're going to be eligible for this thing called the entrepreneur incentive, which basically means, all taken together, that if you're selling a small business, your qualified small business shares in Canada, for less than $6.25 million, you will actually pay less tax under this proposal than you would have today.
How so?
Because of one, the LCGE lifetime capital gains exemption increase, as well as also this additional kind of tax credit that you get as an incentive to entrepreneurs. Now, that doesn't really help the tech person, because the tech person wants a $100 million valuation, right? They're not going to be interested in selling a company at $6 million. They might sell their company at $6 million, and if they do, they'll do better by this. Yep. But this really helps the Main Street business, right? This helps the bookstore. This helps the manufacturing company. This helps that traditional small business owner in the goods and services part of the market that isn't tech. And that isn't real estate, and that isn't financial services. Mm-hmm. Those traditional businesses and traditional industries that we want, for example, more of, they're going to potentially do better by this, from a retirement planning perspective. But you asked me the question about why has this noise occurred, and why have we not kind of focused on a little bit more of the facts of the debate? Well, one of the reasons why I think that is because in some sense the government wanted a noisy debate. They wanted this argument about tax fairness because, generally speaking, and the public opinion data kind of shows this, generally speaking, Canadians are in favor of more ways in which we can make our tax system fairer. And given the distribution of wealth and given the intergenerational fairness questions that we face as a society, especially around housing, it's something that caters to talking to young people, which this government really wanted to do. So that's one. I think they wanted us to notice it. They wanted people to yell about it, and they wanted to have a debate, and they're kind of getting that. They haven't gotten the conservatives to engage on the issue, which was probably what they also wanted, but they wanted that from a public opinion perspective. I think the second part of that, though, is it's very complicated, right? Like, you just see in the debate, people think that when we say 67% inclusion rate, that we mean a 67% tax.
Yeah, that's very common.
It's not, right?
Yeah.
Right? Like, they don't understand. And in some sense, you could say from a political perspective, maybe the government made a mistake by picking a very complicated tax to talk about. I think it was still the right play from a wealth and equality perspective. But it's a heavily layered, complex issue. And this is why, a week or so ago, the Prime Minister had to release that video, the three-minute video or so, to explain it. Because I think they needed to put it in very simple terms.
Right. And with respect to the tech industry, I know these tax policies are oftentimes regarded correctly or incorrectly as like a way for different countries to almost compete with each other or attract talent from abroad.
Yeah.
And I know that part of this budget was a multi-billion dollar investment in AI.
Yeah.
If capital gains is not like the relevancy here, what are other ways that the government is kind of trying to make sure that Canada remains a competitive market or place to incubate a new technology idea and kind of focus on innovation? And
so you mentioned AI. That's really key. Obviously, right now, there's a bidding war that's going on for talent. Canada starts from a really strong place because we have great research that happens here. We have among the highest per capita research and innovation around AI in the world. And that's partly, in fact, a consequence of public policy, because people decided 20 years ago to invest in things like the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, which is what has done a lot of the original thinking and work on AI models in the world. And had governments not done that, someone would have invented AI, but whether that would have been Yasha Bengio and some of the other, and Hinton and others, who knows, but they may not have done it here. And so we've benefited from having that research. I think the second piece, which is interesting, that was also in the budget, has not gotten a lot of attention, is the government instituted basically a new accelerated capital cost allowance associated with investments in intellectual property and data, right? Mm-hmm. And we hear a lot, especially from some of the folks like Jim Balsillie and John Ruffalo, that data is very important, that who owns the data, how we own the data, how we protect the data is going to matter to the ability to commercialize value in the future. Well, Canada's taken a major step forward in that, in creating an incentive to say that anybody who invests in data and IP is going to be able to effectively write off and immediately expense all of those investments. That's a massive win, especially for traditional businesses who are thinking about how they can invest in things like AI to apply it inside their own businesses, right? We know that adoption of technology generally, but especially AI, is very low in the Canadian economy relative to other parts of the world, which is ironic given that we have such research here. Things like that, accelerated capital cost allowance, is a meaningful way in which we can encourage people to invest.
It's interesting you bring that up, because an entrepreneur on the podcast, someone that we've met with a couple times, name's Anthony Lacavera, and he was talking about mm-hmm. this guy, Hinton, that you just yeah. mentioned, where he, during the 90s, like actually invented AI here yep. at University yep. of Toronto. Yep. And then Google poached him to go work at Google to work on their AI, and created market cap for Google, which is an American company. And it would have been great if somehow Canada could have like retained him, and some kind of Canadian company could have like benefited from that yeah. like capital growth.
Yeah.
I think that's a systemic problem, and has nothing to do with taxes really, but it is something interesting that most people don't know, that Canada was such a big hub for AI.
No, absolutely. And I think that it, you know, it's the typical Canadian story, right? Of you develop the research here, you develop the original idea, and then to get the capital to scale and to actually monetize it, you have to go to the US or you go somewhere else. Now, part of that is access to capital. And I think we, as a country, amongst the structural problems that we face, we don't have a deep enough capital market. We got to think about how we can extend that. And one of the things that's also really important in the budget is that Minister Freeland is working with or is wanting to work with some of our pension funds, who are a big source actually of sending capital right. abroad, right? Sending our Canadian dollars that we as savers have all put into the pot, sending that abroad to buy foreign companies when we could be thinking about how we could be investing in Canada. That's important. But number two, the other reason why why that typical Canadian story of having to go abroad happens is because the things that you need after you've gotten the money in order to scale up is you need the marketing, you need the administration, the business development skills that come with building out a company to scale. And we just don't, if you look at, you know, talent pools, and I work at the University of Toronto, and we just don't have as many students in our country that are going through those professional programs as opposed to other graduation pathways. And we probably need to also be thinking about how we can change the mix there, because if we have more talent in that space, it will be easier for Canadian companies to stay here.
So in a sense, it's almost like too many, not to say too much STEM, but like too many engineers and not enough like BD marketing kind of.
You need a balance. Types. Need a balance of all those things. But yes, I mean, we have certainly hit it out of the park on STEM, ironically. Yeah. It's ironically taking a few more of the humanity folks and I, you know, teach at the adjacent side of humanities, yeah. And bringing them also into or engaging them into professional programs as well.
I just want to touch on something that you mentioned regarding, tax policy mm-hmm. and other countries as well. Oftentimes we see, you know, through economics, we learn about interest rate parity and yeah. how foreign exchange markets kind of equalize through yeah. interest rates. There's levers that are at the disposal of governments, and one of the biggest ones are taxes and support. Is this something in your experience that you've competed with other countries around or aligned with other countries around tax policy?
So Canada's done a lot in the last number of years, especially provoked by the U.S. tax changes of 2018 under Donald Trump, to look at kind of our tax competitiveness situation, especially from an investment perspective. There was a whole raft of tax investment incentives that were created in 2018 to respond to the U.S. tax cuts. It actually meant that Canada reclaimed and went further on the marginal effective tax rate and our advantage on that front for a new dollar of investment. So if you were to think about where you could locate a dollar of investment, on average, depending on, you know, across industries, some industries will be higher, some industries will be lower, but on average, marginal new dollar of investment, where is it going to go? Canada actually has the lowest marginal effective tax rate on new investment relative to most of our OECD peers, even lower than the United States. And what's interesting is those incentives back in 2018 are now starting to, or will start to slowly unwind, because they were meant to be temporary incentives, both in Canada and the United States. As those incentives unwind, potentially, we'll see whether Donald Trump wants to extend them if he's elected. Yeah. But as they unwind, that tax advantage between Canada and the U.S. is actually going to increase. It's actually going to increase more. So we'll be more tax advantaged over time. But what I think is interesting to your question about how to create that parity of opportunity of investment, I think we need to go beyond just looking at taxes, right? Because what's interesting to me is that we know that Canada and Canadian companies generally have been underinvesting in things like technology, capital goods, IP. And so where do most of those things come from? We often import those from outside the country. And so that means that, you know, we're probably importing them at a 25% or 30% surcharge because we're paying for them in US dollars, right? I've always wondered, is there something to be said for how governments can work to help to address that currency rate risk that you face to going to buy a US piece of technology or capital good? Now, that may seem like an inconvenient thing for a politician to say because you would want to naturally say, well, no, you should buy the Canadian good, right? But it's true that if we want our businesses to be more capitalized, we're probably going to have to import more of that technology. And in the short run, that actually would be productivity enhancing for Canada. And that's probably one area where I would say both provincial and federal governments could do more.
Very well said. And I think we've unearthed a couple things about this tax policy is that it's part of a much bigger picture.
Yep.
And a much bigger policy objective. Given your experience working with the Trudeau government, how do you see this budget, the most recent one, falling into Trudeau and the Liberals' plan for Canada over the next 10 years, assuming they remain in power? You talked about housing, yeah. You talked about strategic investments, mm-hmm. And searching for fiscal space, right? How do we find the dollars to pay for this? And it seems like this policy is one of those capabilities, but what's the bigger picture that perhaps the headlines aren't capturing?
So even setting aside this recent budget, I think if you were to look at what is the kind of economic strategy that the government has been informed by over the last number of years, it's one, the trying to draw up more talent and enhancing the quality of our talent within the Canadian economy, right? So poverty reduction is part of that strategy because the more we can reduce poverty, the more that we can put in place things like early learning and childcare, it enhances labor supply. And as we enhance labor supply and labor force participation, more people want to work. They get potentially and earn a better living. But also it means that we are able to push off some of our demographic challenges as a country, right? And we'll be able to become a more productive economy by fully unleashing the resources that we have amongst the talented workforce that we have. That's important because as you think about housing is a barrier to people being able to participate meaningfully in the economy. So to the extent that this budget helps to address that problem, I think that's very, very important. And how it pays for that is obviously very, very important. Number two is how we support that transition towards a decarbonized future. Canada's obviously benefited significantly from having these great oil and gas resources as a country and mining resources as a country. We have a responsibility to develop those resources and steward them very well. But it also means we actually have more risk around what a net zero future looks like as a country. We need to transition more quickly, right, and more effectively to make sure that we own a future in which there's going to be less demand for those resources potentially in the future. Mm-hmm. And this budget, again, also one of the things that it does is, you know, it helps to pay for investments in things like zero emissions vehicle manufacturing, critical minerals exploration, because if Canada can own the end-to-end parts of that supply chain, from taking the mineral out of the ground to developing the EV battery and then putting the EV battery into a Canadian-built ZEV car or vehicle, we're gonna own the future. And in a sense, what we're seeing right now is a bit of a manufacturing renaissance, right? Mm-hmm. Canada's not only maintaining those legacy auto investments, we're actually getting new facilities opened and built in this country. The fact that Honda has come in and is potentially going to open 4 new manufacturing plants just in Canada, that's an amazing new story. It's the kind of renaissance, manufacturing renaissance that we haven't seen since really, the auto pack days. And I guess the last thing I would say is, the last two things I would say is, you know, part of the, I think the Prime Minister's economic legacy is one, getting big things built, right? So we're turning on the Trans Mountain Pipeline this month. We're going to soon see the LNG Canada facility on the West Coast open up. It's one of the biggest construction projects in the country. That obviously, those things preceded this budget, but those things have all been helped by very specific public policy decisions. And the last thing I would say is, you know, AI, right? Canada has a world-leading position to play in AI. And this budget helps to at least maintain our competitiveness where, you know, jurisdictions like France are putting even more money on the table. Now, we can have a debate whether Canada needs to do more to match that, but the point is we couldn't sit on the sidelines and not do it. Mm. And not spending that money because we decided we didn't have the money to spend would have probably put us at a great disadvantage.
So Speaking of France and also the race to own this carbon neutral future, mm-hmm. the Inflation Reduction Act is one of the things that the European Union is kind of almost a little bit worried about, because it's less collaborative than you would expect out of something like a Biden administration, because they're trying mm-hmm. to repatriate all their manufacturing supply chains in. And obviously Canada could benefit to that to some extent by being next to the US. But what would you say our like strategic approach in the context of the US Inflation Reduction Act would
be? So it's interesting. So when the IRA first appeared in Canada, obviously there was one kind of instant reaction that some of us had in government, which was, well, this is clearly a threat and we need to be very worried about it. But the other kind of instant reaction that some of us had was, well, we've been doing this for a while and the US is welcome to the party. And, they obviously, whenever they get interested in something, they have the scale to, you know, push the rest of us around a little bit. But, you know, what they're doing is actually very consistent with what Canada had been looking at or already in the process of doing prior to the legislation passing in 2022. Mm-hmm. Canada was already putting in place a tax structure that said that if you want to open a ZEV manufacturing facility in Canada, we're going to cut your tax rate, your corporate tax rate, by 50%. Now, the U.S. has done that in a very different way. They're giving production subsidies. But the point is the same. We're all trying to chase how to incentivize money to flow into these new areas, whether it's zero emissions vehicle manufacturing or whether it's semiconductor manufacturing, right? And so Canada, I think, has maybe differently than the EU, has no choice, but because we sit across the border from the United States, but to ensure that we compete on all or most of those things, and probably is more exposed to that risk than the European Union is, because, you know, if you think about semiconductors or even ZEV facilities, you're going to probably need some European manufacturing hub anyway if you want to be able to export those goods into those markets, because, you know, there's just still an ocean that separates the European market from the North American market. So it's not like nothing's going to happen in those jurisdictions. But it did probably mean that we had to pursue some of those zero emission vehicle manufacturing deals with a bit more aggressively and probably a bit more generously for those companies than what the Europeans had to do in order to respond. But I think what's interesting is that everybody, as a result of the IRA, even if they were already pursuing those things, had to sit up and kind of kick into new gear, because there's no way that you could let the US own this stuff.
Yeah. And in terms of owning the future, one of the things that we've heard a lot of over the past few years is Canada almost needs more Canadian companies to export Canadian products and goods out to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So if you're going to own the future, I know we've had these announcements of investments from like Honda or other foreign multinational manufacturers kind of building plants in Canada and using our skilled labor. But and that's one thing. It's another thing to maybe have your own, use that skilled labor to have a Canadian car company or some other form of Canadian company that is exporting its goods to the world. How do you think we can maybe push towards that?
Or because I was thinking we've talked about this before, like a lot. It's like Canada manufactures parts for cars all around the world, but doesn't have a car company, right? Yeah. We spend lots of money on training AI folks so that they could go overseas. And like to your point about like, well, if we can reduce poverty through education and whatnot, well, what's the point if they leave, you know, and go to like Florida or California or New York, you know?
Dubai.
Yeah. All my friends are talking about Dubai nowadays, right? So I feel like Canada has to do a better job at marketing themselves, like these other states and countries are, in order to retain that, but also pull people from other countries to Canada as well. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, look, we need builders, right? We need people who are going to go off and build companies. And I take the point that I think we said earlier, you know, we've seen a decline in entrepreneurship in Canada, and that's a problem. And part of it as well is that we also don't have a business culture of investment in this country, right? Our businesses just don't invest the same way that they do in other countries. And the consequence of that is more money goes in passive forms back to shareholders. And it just sits on the sidelines. It gets reinvested. And, you know, if it goes into a pension fund, then 85 cents on that dollar is going to exit Canada, right? And so we need to deepen that access to capital and make it more interesting and attractive to want to start those businesses. But what's interesting, though, about the auto sector, right? We had a Canadian auto company at one time, Bricklin Motors and a few others. They didn't go so well, right? So I'm not saying that's a story of destiny for a Canadian company, but... You know, I'm not also sure that more Canadian companies necessarily are going to mean that, you know, we will get the highest value and longest lasting jobs and prosperity out of the marginal investment in that space, right? You have to really look at where your comparative advantage is. And, you know, Canada starts from having great assets, both in its people and its resources. And, you know, I think there's real opportunity around, you know, energy transmission, energy research, because that's a space that we know as Canadians very, very well. We've done a lot of innovation in that space. You're going to see a lot of startups start to probably think about battery development and the components of battery development and parts, right? Like, there's nothing wrong with having a lot of really strong Canadian companies like Magna and others in that space, because that actually is a high degree of innovation, right? In if we think about even just in the context of vehicles. So I don't look at it necessarily from a sovereignty perspective that we need more of those Canadian companies, but we just need to have more active investment in Canada. We need more people who want to take risks in Canada. And I mean, it may sound odd for me to say that at the same time in which I'm saying I'm in favor of a capital gains tax increase. but we can probably try to do both. We should.
Just because this kind of fits with the conversation that we've had about like competition and just Canada's business culture in general, what would you say is like driving the lack of like investment domestically in Canada's business culture? Because it almost seems, at least from my perspective, and this is my opinion, you have somewhat like an oligopolistic structure in a lot of different industries where they are, you know, they benefit from the economies of scale. They kind of sit on their laurels. They don't need to continuously be investing in new solutions and innovations in order to compete with their competitors, because they can just dominate 30 to 40% of a market and collect the revenue. Yeah. So how would you say that like competition maybe factors in?
It's a major factor. So there's been very good research done by Statistics Canada that shows that, you know, one of the reasons why there's been a lack of dynamism amongst Canadian businesses, or a slowdown in dynamism among Canadian businesses in the last several decades, is because we've seen an increased concentration of larger companies, and those larger companies stifle the ability to have creative destruction and turnover in a society. And there's therefore less innovators and less competition, right? And the less competition that our Canadian companies are exposed to, the less innovative those products are going to be, the higher prices we will pay as consumers, and the less dynamic those companies will be in terms of thinking about how to grow the extensive margin. You know, there's a very interesting conversation I had recently with a large consulting company in Canada who shall remain nameless, who had been doing some research comparing the earnings calls that happen for Canadian publicly traded companies versus U.S. publicly traded companies, and just doing a content analysis of like, what are the things that people talk about on those calls? Are they different in Canada than the U.S.? One of the ways that they are different in Canada is that oftentimes the market analysts will be pushing the companies on, so what's the dividend rate, right? Where are you going to increase your dividend? Where, you know, what can we expect for return of capital? In the U.S., a lot of, because many of those companies that are, you know, S&P 500 companies are
growth.
Because they're global, right? If you want to buy buying the S&P index, you're buying a global index, right? Where a lot of the dollars that accrue to U.S. companies are actually from across the world. And those market analysts are asking questions about what's your extensive margin? How are you growing into new markets? How are you competing in your ability to grab market share? We're not talking about that in Canada. We're not talking about that in Canada because, in part, we have concentration of market structures that is heavily dependent on a lack of competition. Think about financial services, right? Telecom and, to a certain extent, airlines and stuff like that. But also, it's just not in our culture. And, you know, it's funny, the Canadian Council of Innovators in pushing back on the budget, they've said, well, you know, often we hear that Canadian business culture is to blame. I actually do think it is to blame. I actually do think we have a business culture problem in this country. And that's not about demonizing Canadian business leaders. It's just we're not thinking about and talking about those issues. And I just think, you know, part of these problems that we face, oftentimes when I would be in government, I would say, well, you know, sure, you want to come to me to solve this public policy on a public policy basis. Public policy's tried lots of different levers to enhance productivity over time and yet gotten to where we are with mixed results. What is the business community doing about that? Why is the business community not talking about these problems? Because these are ultimately profitability issues, right? And lack of dynamism in our businesses is eventually a risk to growth that all business leaders should be concerned about.
What do you mean by dynamism?
Well, so I mean, you can look at it a couple of different ways. One is competition, lack of competition, because that has a knock-on effect to innovation, but also the lack of new the new creation of businesses, as well as also the lack of investment on the part of businesses, right? Like if you compare Canadian businesses to US businesses, we invest far less in capital and machinery, equipment, IP, than our US counterparts do. And the consequence of that is that it limits future growth, it limits productivity, and also means over time that there's going to be lower or slower growing wages that go back to workers.
So like R&D is what you mean?
R&D is part of it, but it's not just R&D. But R&D absolutely is part of it because, you know, we don't have the corporate labs in Canada, right? The way a lot of large US corporates have been investing in. I mean, it's funny. You look at the CHIPS Act in the US, right? So in the space of having been passed, basically all the money in the space of about 24 months or less than 24 months has been allocated, and factories are being built by Intel and NVIDIA, right? And that has not subsequently, you know, if you think about, say, carbon capture, utilization, storage in Canada, we're still years into this debate about what the structure of those investments should look like. Not one project. Well, sorry, there has been a project, but not, mm-hmm. but like very few projects have actually proceeded from what we were expecting was going to be a rush of investment activity. Now, those projects may still happen, and I hope that they do. But my point is, you know, we just aren't as willing sometimes to take the risks in Canada as some of our counterparts are.
Almost culturally. Yeah. And yeah, I have witnessed that as well. Cause there was this time about a year ago after Collision, we had this idea for some renewable energy resource. We approached U of T. They basically had an office entirely dedicated to trying to find entrepreneurs who specialize in commercializing their technology. Mm-hmm. And they were very excited to meet myself and this other person that I was working with this on. Cause like you said, there was a scarcity of people that had that kind of business development, taking the innovations and expanding it, skill set. But at the same time, it just feels like the people that do have that skill set almost just would prefer to go to the United States.
Yeah, so, look, I mean, we have to be honest with ourselves. The U.S. is a cool place to be for many parts. You know, maybe some parts of the U.S. you don't want to go, but the U.S. is a really cool place, right? Like California, Florida, Texas, you know, parts of the Northeast, they're all really cool places to live as well as to do business. And I think we do have to recognize that cool factor, combined with the fact that they have access to capital, combined with the fact that they have scale, combined with the fact that they have market ecosystems that people want to eventually be part of, makes it really hard, right, to make an argument that, you know, you should come to a cold environment. That it's about the same tax rates overall, but like I'm going to have to make a very complicated argument to you about why that is, because, you know, there'll be some states like Florida where you don't pay any income taxes, Texas as well.
Then you have an expensive gated community.
Right? Like, I think we have to acknowledge that sometimes it's a very intellectual argument. You know, I think Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver are cool places to live. Some people can debate whether or not they are as cool as they used to be, given some of our other infrastructure and livability challenges. But the point is, what Canada has that a lot of those other places have, but maybe not to the same degree, is Canada has a lot of talent. And one of the reasons why we saw our tech sector grow as fast and as big as it did in the last number of years before COVID, was because you could get that talent at relatively low labor cost relative to those other jurisdictions, right? So if you were a multinational and you were looking to open an office for Google, Amazon, et cetera, you'd want to be here because you could get the same talent as you could get in Boston or in San Francisco at lower costs. Mm-hmm. And that was really attractive. Now, the challenge is, of course, that lower cost comes with a really high also living standard for a lot of people in Toronto, right? And so it doesn't mean that those people are earning more than they would get.
We want to be cheaper Americans.
Exactly, right? Exactly. Yeah. So how sustainable is that advantage over the long term? That's where I think, back to our original point about housing, it's actually super important to how we create the selling feature about Canada. Because if we are going to remain this, you know, pluralistic place that brings in talent from across the world and also develops talent here and wants to keep that talent, housing is at the core of how we do that.
You're good.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
It's almost like I've been in politics.
Yeah. It's like you're trained on this.
Could I ask on the topic of housing? I think it's a great example. You talked about different states in the United States. Mm-hmm. They all have different tax policy, different incentive structures within the states. Housing, I think, is a huge topic for Canada for the next 10 years. And it requires both federal and provincial collaboration. How do you see Canada's track record of federal and provincial collaboration on important topics like housing, but also AI, making Canada cool? How does the federal government and the provincial government make Canada cool?
Subsidize Drake.
Well, no, look, it's not great, right? Like, I think that the state of federal-provincial relations in Canada has always been challenged. I'm someone, you know, in my master's program, spent a bit of time thinking about that years ago. But compared to other jurisdictions in the world, like Australia, for example, we don't have as much coordination and coherence between our subordinate levels of government and our federal government around some of those things. Part of that is by design, because we decided to set certain things in the Constitution that says you're responsible for this and I'm responsible for that. But as we found over time, there's a blurring of those lines, right? Housing technically, in a very strict interpretation of the Constitution, is a provincial responsibility. Prime Minister kind of got in trouble last summer when he suggested that was the case, even as he was saying, I'm investing more, but like, remember, I'm not the only person responsible for this.
It all comes down to transfer payments at that point almost.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And Canadians, you know, like, we don't think about the Constitution in our daily lives. We don't sit around saying, well, you know, I really wish Doug Ford would deal with this versus Justin Trudeau or Olivia Chow, right? We just want problems solved. And increasingly, a lot of problems are blurred between levels of government. But there's not that incentive structure sometimes for all three of those governments to sit down and figure out what to do. That's not to say that we can't, and it's not to say that we don't, because there are examples of that I could point to as to how that, you know, some good examples of how that happens. And I think in COVID there was some good examples of that happening. But it's interesting because you mentioned AI. We don't, at least I couldn't name you two or three things that the Ontario government is doing to encourage AI. I mean, that's really been something that Quebec government has taken that on a little bit, BC government a little bit too, but I can't tell you that I think that Doug Ford is something he cares about, when in fact Ontario has a substantial tech sector that depends on the future of those things, right? So I'm just saying, I think there's a lot of, at the heart of a lot of our challenges is this coordination problem with the levels of government.
Thank you.
Well, we're coming up on the final half hour, so let's just close it out then.
Okay. Want me to ask the last two? You got this?
I can do the last one if you want.
Okay.
Yeah, that's cool.
Where can people find you online?
So www.mb, as in Meredith Bosenkool, mbpolicy.com.
Awesome, cool. Now, this podcast is obviously called What They Didn't Teach You in School. So everybody that we bring on, we ask this exact same question to all of our guests. And the question is, what's one piece of wisdom that you wish you knew much sooner in your life?
How to present well and how to convey information. I mean, and I see this actually in my daily life now that I teach at the University of Toronto. And I saw it when I was in the Prime Minister's office, where I would get all of these master students that would come in as interns in the summer. And they were all very good. Like, they're all very, very smart. But they've been taught to convey information in a certain way, right? It's like, I'm going to speak in the dispassionate third person. I'm going to write an essay that tells you, here are the three things I want to prove to you, and then tell you that I've told you about those things. The ability to get beyond that very academic structure of how you convey information and just be able to plainly explain something and explain it in a very convincing fashion, confidently taking a position on what you believe, is not something that we teach very much in the academic environment. It's something we try to do at Monk. But it's something that I have seen in my own experience in government and in the business world that we need a lot more of, right? Those very practical skills of how to take analytical information, how to find the right information and synthesize it and communicate it is super important.
Yeah. And evidently you're very good at that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Awesome. Sweet. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This is
absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This was really
so much.
Interesting.
Good job,
cheers,
guys.
Yeah. Sweet. Awesome.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you guys.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
There you go.
Awesome. This is great.
Valentina, take us out here until next time.